This is the battleground.
Hi, I'm Jeff Rosenberg. Tune in to the Song Circle every Friday afternoon at 1:30 p.m.
Turn their backs on the grisly scenes, traced to the privileged sons. And your death will come soon.
You never know what you'll hear next.
KBOO is hiring a full-time development director. We have extended the deadline to Sunday, April 2nd. For the complete job description, please visit kboo.fm/development-hire23. KBOO is an equal opportunity employer.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
This is Rising Up with Sona Ali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll mark Transgender Day of Visibility with a roundtable discussion featuring three special guests. Carl Charles, a senior attorney in the Southern Regional Office of Lambda Legal, located in Atlanta, Georgia. Ebony Harper, founder and executive director of California Transcends, a statewide initiative working to promote the health and wellness of transgender people throughout the state of California. And Maybe a Girl, who serves on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in Los Angeles and became the first drag queen elected to public office in the United States. She's also a candidate for California's 30th congressional district. We'll discuss the relentless right-wing attacks on transgender rights and how they can be beaten back. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. March 31st marks Transgender Day of Visibility around the world. It was founded in 2009 by Rachel Crandall Crocker, who used a Facebook post to encourage people to celebrate the rights and dignity of transgender people instead of mourning them. At that time, Transgender Day of Remembrance, marking the victims of murder, was the only formal day recognizing the community. In 2021, President Joe Biden issued the first ever presidential proclamation marking Transgender Day of Visibility. Today, the right-wing culture war that has taken aim at, quote, wokeness, the right to an abortion, the teaching of history in schools, has also targeted LGBTQ folks, and especially transgender people. There are currently at least 340 state-level legislative attacks on LGBTQ people, according to the Human Rights Campaign. 150 are getting transgender people, the largest number ever. I'm so pleased to announce today a roundtable discussion for Yes Magazine focusing on transgender rights. My guests include Carl Charles, a senior attorney in the Southern Regional Office of Lambda Legal, located in Atlanta, Georgia. During his time at Lambda Legal, Carl has been involved in litigating many cases, expanding and solidifying federal civil rights protections for transgender people. He served as counsel in numerous high-level cases, including BPJ versus West Virginia Board of Education, a federal lawsuit challenging West Virginia's law banning girls and women who are transgender from participating in school sports. In addition to litigation, Carl contributes to federal and state legislative and policy efforts concerning protections for transgender youth and adults in a variety of settings. Prior to joining Lambda Legal, he served as a staff attorney with the LGBTQ Rights and Family Recognition Project at A Better Balance. Also joining our panel today is Ebony Harper, founder and executive director of California Transcends, which is a statewide initiative working to promote the health and wellness of transgender people throughout the state of California, with a focus on Black and Brown transgender communities. The initiative aims to strengthen statewide and national coalitions to work collaboratively to provide a rapid response to combat human rights abuses, health disparities, intolerance, scarcity, and societal oppression that target and disproportionately impact the transgender community. And last but not least is Maybe A Girl. Maybe is running for California's 30th Congressional District. In 2022, she made history when she won the primary election against seven other candidates, becoming the first openly trans non-binary person to ever advance to a general election for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. She currently serves as treasurer and at-large representative for the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in Los Angeles, and upon her election to that body in 2019, she became the first drag queen elected to public office in the United States. Maybe is responsible for forming the Silver Lake LGBTQIA Advocates Committee, the first queer-focused committee in the LA Neighborhood Council system. She's also a founding member and serves on the executive committee of the LGBTQ Plus Alliance of Los Angeles Neighborhood Councils, which is recognized as the first city-backed initiative for the LGBTQ Plus community in LA. Her campaign platform for Congress includes universal health care, housing for all, education for all, environmental justice, racial justice, LGBTQIA rights, reproductive rights, alleviating homelessness, and advocating against war. Welcome to our roundtable, Carl, Ebony, and Maybe.
Thank you.
So let me start, Carl, with you. What does Trans Day of Visibility mean to you? President Biden, 2 years ago, made the first presidential proclamation marking Transgender Day of Visibility. It's only been around since 2009 from the history that I could figure out. But how important is Trans Day of Visibility in 2023, this year where we've seen unprecedented levels of legislative attacks specifically against transgender communities?
Thanks so much, Sonali, for that question and for having me here today for this important discussion with my co-panelists, Maybe and Ebony. And I think you set up the question very well, which is to say Trans Day of Visibility as a recognized day, even in the community, is quite young. And comes from the context of it is that we have for much longer had Trans Day of Remembrance, which was started in the late 90s, early 2000s, as a response to really the disproportionate deaths of trans people through violence. And so Trans Day of Visibility, in my understanding and sort of in the broader community, is a response to we don't just need days to remember those we've lost. We need days to be out and proud and talking about ourselves, our experiences, and our community. The other thing I'll add is it's hard in this particular political climate that we're living through in 2023 to feel anything but visible as a trans, non-binary, or gender non-conforming person. We are unfortunately very visible, especially to our opponents who would like to weaponize our identities for their own political aims. And so I think this day of trans visibility is particularly important as a community to reclaim some of that visibility in ways that feel regenerative and celebratory and affirming, as opposed to feeling really the target of a cultural a war that is not our making.
Ebony, what are your thoughts on Transgender Day of Visibility and why that symbolism is so important?
Trans Day of Visibility is important because of several reasons. Transgender people have historically had to live in the shadows and on the margins of society. And Trans Day of Visibility is a day where we're saying we're here, we're trans. It's a day for our allies to say, you know, we love trans people, we accept trans people. So it's an important day. And especially during these times right now where there's so much anti-trans hate in this country, allyship is an important thing right now. So this year is especially special for me because of all the divisiveness that we're seeing throughout the country. And so it's an important day for allies as well to say, you know, we support the trans community and we're not going to feed into this divisiveness that's roaming throughout the country. And we love and support trans folks.
Maybe what about you and your thoughts on Trans Day of Visibility? Do you feel that even Biden's act of recognition, important as it was and symbolic as it was, has of course then created a target for right-wing attacks? Maybe sometimes more visibility for an issue, especially when a Democrat does it, makes Republicans consider it a target, but yet of course the price of silence is too great, so it becomes this catch-22. I'm thinking about abortion rights, for example, where feminists and the Supreme Court took a really strong position on it, but then there was just this reactionary backlash, and now of course we see what's happened to abortion rights decades later.
Yeah, I think Trans Day of Visibility is so important, especially in this political climate. I certainly appreciate Biden recognizing Trans Day of Visibility. I do think, on the one hand, it is symbolic, especially in this political climate. So on the one hand, it's really great to have a president recognizing Trans Day of Visibility. On the other hand, I wish that the president was pushing for legislation that would actually protect trans people. You know, we've seen historic levels of anti-trans, anti-LGBTQIA, anti-drag bills moving through state legislatures all across the United States. And we're starting to see federal legislation being introduced that is anti-LGBTQIA. I think for me, one of the scariest things about seeing that there's been over 450 anti-LGBTQIA bills in 2023 alone is that they're starting to creep into the federal legislature. You know, I think for a while people were thinking, you know, these anti-trans antics are only happening in, you know, very red states like Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma. And we're starting to see these kinds of bills being introduced, again, not just at the federal level, but also in states that are, you know, historically considered blue states. A lot of folks aren't aware that there was recently a bill introduced in California that is an anti-trans bill. It's called AB 1314. And essentially it would require schools to out transgender youth to their parents within 3 days of finding out that they identify with a gender outside of what they were assigned at birth. And it's really scary. And a lot of folks are saying, well, you know, it doesn't really have a chance of passing in California. It's just the suggestion alone that is terrifying. It's offensive. And it makes me really worried for trans youth these days. I think it's especially scary because, you know, I think for a while we thought that things were getting better, and they are in many ways. You know, I think general societal acceptance of trans people has been improving over the years. And I think that all of this anti-trans legislation is backlash to that. And I will say they can't force us back into the closet. They're not going to erase us. It's only going to make us louder and prouder and stronger. But I think it's particularly important to have Trans Day of Visibility, and not just Trans Day of Remembrance, to show that we are here, we are people, we are surviving, and we are thriving. We are beautiful human beings, And I think that's so important to recognize. I think Trans Day of Visibility is also important because trans isn't just one thing. I think a lot of people have in their mind this idea of what a transgender person looks like or how they act or what they're supposed to be doing, but there's no right or wrong way to be a trans person. And I think that's something that's really important to showcase.
Ebony, what about the attacks on transgender people in states as supposedly liberal and progressive as California? As Maybe was saying, even in California, we're seeing these sorts of attacks like we're seeing in other right-wing dominated states. You're here in California. How does your work with California Transcends take on the fact that in a liberal state like California, we see these attacks as well?
Historically, it's definitely a bait and switch. This is their playbook from Roger Ailes, the guy who started Fox News, to Rush Limbaugh. They will put out the most divisive thing, and it won't be rooted in the truth. It's a playbook that they've had, you know, since the 1960s. It's, you know, say something very egregious, something that would make people angry. You know, switch it up as far as like when it comes to policy, they will have something in the back burner. So yes, I do agree that the divisiveness is a tool, but it's also a tool for election season and trying to feed into what people may be angry about or what religious folks may not accept, and trying to like recruit folks in the banner of, you know, these people are trying to take over our country. These people, it's always rooted in conspiracy. So even if you go back to the, you know, 1960s and Jim Crow era, back then it was like the black folks are you know, gonna, you know, hurt our women and hurt our children and if we desegregate. And so then from there it was Muslim folks and then LGBT folks. And so the pendulum has swung back to LGBT folks as far as like their playbook. But what's interesting is, you know, you see a lot of these politicians caught up in LGBT scandal. Think about George Santos. There's a hypocrisy. There is a selective outrage when it comes to, you know, LGBT community. And what you're seeing now is LGBT conservatives that are kind of self-hatred, right? Caitlyn Jenner, George Santos, who's steeped in a lot of lies and deception, but also very harmful to the LGBT community because he supports policies that are rooted in bigotry. And Caitlyn Jenner, the same thing. And she's also feeding into the narrative of this grooming narrative and this narrative that trans people in particular are being harmful to the overall population, which is not rooted in truth. Most trans folks I know just want to live their life and, you know, live and wants access to employment, wants access to housing, like everyone else in healthcare. There's not some big conspiracy. There's no trans agenda. The only trans agenda I know is an equal shot at life. And the American pursuit of happiness.
Carl, you are intimately involved with the legislative landscape and the incredible attacks that we're seeing today from, you know, everything from in Florida, the threats to take children away from their parents, which is one of the worst things you can do to children, to Tennessee, which is a ban on where drag shows can be held or whether they can be held at all, which is very much seen as an attack on transgender rights. This spectrum, this landscape currently of these state level attacks on transgender rights, even when the majority of them don't pass, as maybe was just suggesting, doesn't the mere act, the mere fact of their existence have a very detrimental impact, especially on young people?
Without a doubt. Trans youth, like all youth, are keen consumers of the political social environment in which they and their families exist. You know, while they may not perhaps understand the exact legal verbiage of a bill seeking to prevent them from accessing gender affirming care, they certainly can interpret the stress and concern and worry and fear of their parents or legal guardians. We've heard from many parents who have fled states where they were going to be targeted by legislation should it pass, right? Prime examples of Arkansas and Alabama come to mind. And I want to point out to the audience, of course, that those laws have been enjoined by the federal district courts in those states while litigation about the constitutionality of those laws are pending. But the sort of uncertainty that poses is too much for families to bear, right? The laws are stopped while the lawsuits proceed, but lawsuits do come to an end. I know sometimes they seem like they don't, but you know, after 2 or 3 years, there will be a conclusion to that lawsuit, and there's not a guarantee that that injunction will stay in place. So hopefully, of course, as advocates, we believe in the appropriateness and strength of those challenges, and think that they will ultimately be successful, but to a degree, the outcome is out of our hands. And so I don't fault families who are leaving for more inclusive and historically safe states for LGBTQI people. Now, that being said, there are many of us who will not leave the states we are in, who cannot leave and won't leave. And leaving a state should never be a suggestion of a solution for people who are discriminated against. I'm based in Georgia. As may be outlined, there are a lot of bad things happening in the Southeast in 2023 so far. And LGBTQ people have built homes and lives and communities here. And we should not be expected to leave just because of the hateful rhetoric that is being trumpeted from our state capitals. These are places that we deserve to be just as much as anybody else, right?
March 31st marks Transgender Day of Visibility, the topic of today's special roundtable discussion for Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, and this is Rising Up with Sonali. We'll be back in just a moment with our guests. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Welcome back to part two of our roundtable discussion for Yes Magazine, marking Transgender Day of Visibility, which is March 31st. My guests are Carl Charles, a senior attorney in the Southern Regional Office of Lambda Legal, Ebony Harper, founder and executive director of California Transcends, and Maybe A Girl, who serves on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in Los Angeles and is a candidate for California's 30th Congressional District. Maybe, can you tell us about the fact that you, first of all, in 2019 made history by becoming the first publicly elected transgender person, non-binary person to be elected to public office in the United States, and you're running for Congress in California for California's 30th District in a district that's very Democratic. And if you are elected, if you win election, you could become the first transgender person in the U.S. Congress? This is quite remarkable. Tell me about your political journey.
So when I was elected to the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in 2019, I became the first drag queen ever publicly elected to any sort of public office in the U.S. I am trans, non-binary. My pronouns are she, her, they, them. When I say I was the first drag queen elected, I ran under my stage name, which is Maybe A Girl. I go by Maybe in my everyday life, so that's my name. But I decided to run under my stage name because most of the people in my community knew me under my stage name. And, you know, I ran as my open, authentic self. And I was really, I hate to say surprised, but I was surprised that, you know, that my community would elect somebody like that. And it really was inspiring to me, and it inspired me to run for higher office. And I decided to run for Congress. This is my third time running for Congress. I ran in 2020, 2022, now 2024. And I think, a lot of people underestimated my campaign in 2020 and in 2022. You know, in 2020, I was third out of eight people. I missed advancing to the general election by less than 1%, by only about 1,100 votes. And then in 2022, we ended up winning the primary election, and we moved on to the general. And it was the first time that a trans non-binary person has ever advanced to a general election for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. And, you know, I ended up being, ultimately, I was the runner-up. I was second out of nine people that ran in that race. And what I think was really remarkable about it is, you know, we were outspent over 500-1, and I still ended up getting over 60,000 votes in the general election. I'm very excited about this upcoming election because it's actually going to be an open seat. The person who I had been running against, he was in office for 22 years, Adam Schiff, and he's announced that he is not seeking re-election in 2024 because he's running for Senate. So given that it's an open seat and that I was the runner-up in 2022, we actually have a really great chance of winning this time. And, you know, I always like to mention that, you know, I don't run to be the first. I run because somebody's got to be first, and somebody's got to knock down some doors to get us there. And whether or not I end up becoming the first trans person federally elected to Congress, I know that I'm at least contributing to the day that that will happen. And it's so important to have somebody who is actually fighting for trans rights in Congress, rather than all of these people, you know, putting forth legislation that is against trans people. And it's like a good friend of mine always says, if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. And trans people are quite literally on the menu right now. As previously mentioned, more than 450 anti-LGBTQIA bills moving across the United States. And yet, how many trans people are actually involved in the legislation, in the coming up with the legislation? Very likely zero. And I think that's the problem. You know, representation is so important, and trans people are not represented right now. You know, we are just starting to see trans people being elected to state offices, which is fantastic. But the fact that we've never had anybody, any trans person federally elected to any office is a problem, especially with all of this anti-trans legislation moving forward. So I think it's so important to have somebody, anybody who is trans, actually, I shouldn't say anybody, but, you know, somebody who actually wants to fight for trans rights rather than against them in our federal legislature.
So Caitlyn Jenner wouldn't be acceptable?
That's exactly who I was thinking of when I hesitated.
Let's talk about culture. So this is the legislative attack, but it's deeply, and policy changes are deeply intertwined with how our culture is built. First of all, I'm wondering, Carl, if you think that these attacks by the right, using legislation, using fear-mongering, are an indication that there was actually really good progress being made to further transgender rights, and to also to shift our culture on trans rights issues in the classroom, in popular culture, you know, in film and television and media. And so culture seems to be this underappreciated but intimate aspect of these attacks.
Yeah, I think that's a, I think that's definitely a component of what we're seeing, right? An undeniable component. I think maybe said it earlier, but we really saw from, you know, around, I would say, the 2010 to about 2016, an explosion of inclusion, acceptance, and visibility for trans people, for people across the trans spectrum, right? So that includes non-binary people, gender non-conforming people. And we saw that in media, in many facets. And we saw a really unprecedented response from the federal government, right? I remember in 2016, during the North Carolina bathroom ban wars around HB2, that the Attorney General under President Obama held a press conference. Loretta Lynch, I think, was her name. And she held a press conference to say, trans people across the US, we see you, we're here for you, we support you. We are suing the state of North Carolina for this unconstitutional law that it has passed, and we're not gonna leave your side, right? And that was really without being hyperbolic, that was unprecedented. That was a historical moment. And a lot of what we saw in the administration that followed President Obama was a backlash and response to that progress.
You know, I think that culture is a big word that's been coming up lately, you know, culture wars. And, you know, this very much is a culture war, but with drastic effects on the people who are being attacked, which is LGBTQIA people, and more specifically trans people. And, you know, in many ways, I think that the overall attack on LGBTQIA people from a legislative point of view, I think, is in many ways a distraction from greater economic issues, greater economic inequity. And so, you know, they are trying to find some sort of scapegoat for, you know, who can we talk about now? Who can we get people upset about? And, oh, let's target trans people. And it's really scary because, you know, a lot of these anti-trans bills have been introduced under the guise of protecting children. And, you know, so a lot of the initial anti-trans bills that we were seeing were, you know, bathroom bills and locker room bills and sports bills. And, you know, under the guise of, oh, we need to protect, you know, cisgender kids and not trans kids, and that trans kids are somehow a threat to cisgender people. And that was extended to adults, that, you know, somehow trans adults are, you know, potentially harmful for people in society. And it's frankly not true. In fact, the opposite is applicable. You know, you don't see trans people trying to put forth legislation to harm any other communities. You know, we're not asking for special rights here. We're just asking to coexist peacefully with the rest of society.
And you know, not to mention that if you are worried about child abuse, sexual child abuse, a huge target would be the Catholic Church and maybe the Boy Scouts of America.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think they're looking in the wrong places for groomers and pedophiles. Mm. You know, I think it's really awful the way that, you know, even just one look on social media, on Twitter, anytime there's a mention of anything that is positive related to trans people, you know, you have the conservatives coming in, you know, saying groomer, pedophile, and there's plenty of other places that you could look for groomers and pedophiles. It's not within drag shows. It's not within, you know, the larger trans community. And yeah, it's really scary times right now. Really scary times. You know, we were talking about earlier about how, you know, how scary it must be to be a queer youth right now. You know, I graduated high school in 2004. And when I was in high school, when I was growing up, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of media talk about queer issues. You know, there were certainly anti-queer legislative efforts, you know, things like DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you know, those sort of things. But the very specific nature of some of these bills that we're seeing today that are direct attacks on trans youth, I can't imagine what it would be like to be a queer youth right now and to see that there are people trying to legislate me out of existence. And I think that's a really, really terrifying concept for trans youth and just trans people in general. And, you know, these culture wars, you know, it's escalating to the point of what started off as supposedly being protections for children. You know, now you have states wanting to ban gender affirming health care for all people. How does that protect children? You know, so the argument has become moot, but it has allowed the rhetoric has allowed these bills to get bigger and scarier and broader.
Ebony, do you think that the intersection of the attacks on critical race theory and on LGBTQ rights are part and parcel of the right wing's culture war to distract us from, as Maybe was saying, economic justice issues?
Yeah, it you know, they're getting recruits by the day based on ignorance, based on ideology that has, these aren't the conservatives of, you know, they're not John McCain as conservatives. These conservatives are from the conspiracy theory ilk, from the QAnon ilk, from the January 6th ilk, from the Donald Trump ilk. So they're not afraid to be hurtful and mean and nasty. And yes, I do see trans kids affected by this and deeply hurt by this. And that's where, like you said, we come in as a trans elder, as the LGBT community, to wrap our arms around as many of the youth as we can and say, you know, while we have some haters, you also have lovers too, and you have people that are here to love and support you. It's the rough road, it is. But, you know, I believe that love is stronger than hate. And yes, as far as like attacks, there are some people that really take what these conservative talking points are saying as a literal thing, and will go shoot up a gay nightclub, you know, because they feel like, you know, trans and even drag queen performers are trying to turn society on its behind, you know, and that is scary. That this new conservative movement, because they're not like John McCain, you know, they're not these conservatives that I grew up seeing. This is a really extremist thing. And what we're seeing is a lot of violence happening because of, you know, what is being spread, disinformation warfare. So, you know, what we've been doing, even as California Transcend, is trying to work with other trans organizers and trans advocacy groups, and kind of developing our own civil rights movement, because these times cause for some civil rights movement. But we also have to be safe in that process, because You know, there are people out there that literally wants to take us out.
March 31st marks Transgender Day of Visibility, the topic of today's special roundtable discussion for Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, and this is Rising Up with Sonali. We'll be back in just a moment with our guests. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Welcome back to part three of our roundtable discussion for Yes Magazine, marking Transgender Day of Visibility, which is March 31st. My guests have been Carl Charles, a senior attorney in the Southern Regional Office of Lambda Legal, Ebony Harper, founder and executive director of California Transcends, and Maybe A Girl, who serves on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in LA and is a candidate for California's 30th Congressional District. Welcome back to the program, Carl, Ebony, and Maybe. And this is the third and final part of our roundtable. There's also, unfortunately, folks on the left who tend to have a blind spot when it comes to transgender rights. You know, there's J.K. Rowling, who arguable whether she's on the left, but I don't know if you saw very recently, Alice Walker came to her defense and even, you know, made this suggestion that somehow young people who are trans ought to wait till they're at least 18 or 20 before they can consider, you know, messing with their bodies. And she was, of course, talking about gender affirming care, a treatment and surgery for those young people who might choose that path in their journey to realizing their true selves. But it was a disappointment to me, someone who looks up to Alice Walker, to see that. And I'm wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a lot of misconceptions around gender-affirming healthcare in general, but specifically gender-affirming healthcare for youth. And, you know, you've got figures like Matt Walsh, you know, saying that, you know, we have to ban genital mutilation on children. And the fact of the matter is, we're not seeing genital mutilation on children. Gender affirming healthcare for youth typically involves puberty blockers. And puberty blockers are reversible. And, you know, these are not being given to 5, 6, 7 year olds. You know, puberty blockers are given once puberty is onset. And if, you know, usually the reason that they'll recommend puberty blockers first is so that trans youth and their families and their doctors have time to make a plan, decide if this is how we want to move forward, and then eventually move forward. But, you know, these aren't, you know, on the fly decisions that, you know, folks are having genitals removed, you know, when they're young children. And I think what is especially appalling about that whole conversation is that genital mutilation on children is happening, but it's happening via circumcision, which is non-consensual for babies, and it's happening on intersex babies and young children, and again, non-consensual. And, you know, the reason that there end up being trans intersex people is because intersex people are victims to childhood surgeries that are often outside of their own consent. And so, and what's also even scarier is that a lot of these anti-trans bills actually make exceptions for intersex children to have surgeries when they're young. So, you know, it's scary because there's a lot of misinformation and a lot of disinformation about what exactly gender-affirming healthcare looks like for adults and for youth.
And any specific thoughts on Alice Walker and J.K. Rowling? And the TERFs, if you will, for those who aren't aware, TERFs.
It's awful. And I think that they've gotten much more bold in their language and the way that they express their opinions. And the thing is, trans people are not threatening the existence of women, of people. And I think it's very awful when you have people who are so well known and have such broad bases and such influence amongst their bases. It's very scary and it's really disheartening. And again, I think a lot of the heart of it is disinformation and misinformation. Of course, there are people who are just flat out hateful, and that's really sad and unfortunate. But I think a lot of people enter this TERF ideology through a conduit that is based off of mis and disinformation.
And just to clarify for those who might not be aware, TERF is T-E-R-F, stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminists. Those feminists, those people who identify as feminists, who feel that somehow transgenderism is a threat to feminist ideals. And so I'm wondering if you think maybe that in terms of that issue you were raising earlier, the distraction issue, that this is something that unfortunately even the left falls prey to. And I'd like to use that as a segue into your platform. You could be the first transgender person ever to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives, and that symbolism alone is a cultural moment. But also, your platform is much, much broader than LGBTQIA rights. You mm-hmm. consider yourself a staunchly progressive candidate. Tell me about the rest of your platform and why that is important, that intersectionality with LGBTQIA rights is important.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I've been mentioned in the media a lot as, you know, the first drag queen elected to office. I've been mentioned in the media a lot as potentially being the first trans person elected to Congress. And LGBTQIA protections and rights are a huge part of my platform. But I think a lot of people misunderstand and think that that's the only thing that I'm running on. When overall my platform is what I like to describe as an intersectional humanitarian platform. It includes universal healthcare, housing for all, education for all, environmental justice, racial justice, reproductive rights. And they, you know, those are all intersectional issues. You know, healthcare justice is queer justice. Healthcare justice is racial justice. Housing justice is queer justice. Housing justice is racial justice. So all of these issues are very interconnected. And when you look at one of the reasons I'm so pro universal healthcare and so pro housing for all is because oftentimes LGBTQIA people and people of color are often left out of healthcare. They're often left out of housing. I've always thought that if everybody had guaranteed healthcare, housing, and education, this would be a much, much better place for everybody. And the fact of the matter is that we can afford these things. You know, when we can afford $1 trillion a year for the military, but somehow there's never money to give healthcare to everybody. Somehow there's never money to give everybody housing or education. And so, the intersection of all of these issues within queer communities and within communities for people of color is so important to recognize. You can't have queer justice without healthcare justice, without housing justice.
Carl, I'm wondering if you also have any thoughts as to moving forward, yes, as a solutions-based journalism outlet. Maybe was just outlining the importance of intersectionality and this very progressive congressional platform, bringing these issues together as a way to, you know, push back against these attacks. Of course, as an attorney, you're in the thick of it, fighting legislatively, but beyond having armies of well-trained, resourced lawyers to beat back the legislative attacks via lawsuits, what do you see as the solutions to the attacks on transgender folks on this Transgender Day of Visibility?
Yeah, thank you. I think maybe set it up really nicely for me to hopefully add a couple of additional points. Lawsuits are not the end all be all, right? They are a post hoc, post harm response, right? And you know, I think they're important. I think they're a stopgap. I've certainly invested a lot of my own personal time and energy into this response, but we must, as a community, have multifaceted advocacy, right, as it pertains to trans justice. We cannot file lawsuits if we're not connected to the people in communities, in trans community across the country who are experiencing harm. And a great deal of work and advancement, both for trans justice, both within and without the community, has happened in grassroots mutual aid ways, right? It has always been the history of the LGBT community that we take care of one another outside often the formal structures of care, right? So it is people taking care of one another when their partner is sick or dealing with a chronic illness or is a person living with a disability. It is people responding to the issues that may be outlined that affect trans people across the spectrum of identity, right, in an intersectional way. So like I said, even though this is the work I do day to day, we have seen the, I think in some ways, the most powerful response to anti-trans legislation and hate come from people in states showing up to the state houses, to the places of power, and saying, this is who we are. We are not going away. You cannot legislate us out of existence, right? The example I like to point to is from South Dakota, where for years, the trans community in South Dakota, the people living in that state, right, a very rural, somewhat, you know, comparatively to Georgia and California, very sparsely populated state, those trans people and their families and people who supported them showed up year after year after year to the state house to say, do not do this, do not do this, right? And they beat it back for years. And that has always been a real testament, an example to me of the ways that community strength and solidarity is as important in some, and in some cases more important than the formal legal response, right? We need people, as maybe as outlined, in the halls of power. We need people in our nation's capital, in the House of Representatives, in the Senate. We need trans people in state legislatures, which they are, and more are continuing to be elected. We need trans people in their communities, right? Building power and solidarity in their communities and not just in a silo, right? As may be outlined, we need folks linking arms with the people in our communities who are fighting for racial justice, who are fighting for reproductive justice, who are fighting for justice for undocumented people and people living with disabilities. We are, all of our issues are so interconnected, and frankly, we need the collective power of one another to combat the issues that affect singular pieces of our groups, right? We need everybody coming together, as cliche as that probably sounds. So,
well, I'm wondering if you've heard, or if either if you've heard of Michaela Kavanaugh, this lawmaker in Nebraska. I don't think she's transgender, but she is blocking an anti-transgender bill with a filibuster going on three weeks as of this recording. And I'm wondering if for you, that's that sort of allyship and solidarity is also really crucial.
It's absolutely crucial. It's needed. You know, we'll probably never get to a point where, you know, we have a majority of trans people in office. So we really are going to need the allyship of folks. And I think what's especially been disappointing in the past several weeks to months is the fact that, you know, there's been a big conversation about all of this anti-LGBTQIA legislation. But a lot of it is coming from within the community itself. And we supposedly have so many allies, especially when we think about Pride Month and everybody in their rainbows, you know, big corporations like Target and Budweiser putting out their rainbows, and yet there's silence right now. And that's really where we need help from you know, organizations and from people, is with things like this, not just marching in the parades with us and not just coming out to party with us. And, you know, the silence has been really deafening. You know, I actually recently posted about how there's 11 other people that are running for the seat that I'm running in, and none of them have spoken about the anti-trans, anti-drag, anti-LGBTQIA legislation. And it's really remarkable to me, because West Hollywood is in my district, one of the largest LGBTQIA communities in the nation. So, you know, we have a massive LGBTQIA population in my district, and yet we don't have anybody talking about these things. And a lot of folks who are running for the seat that I'm running for are already elected officials, and yet they want to represent us on a national scale, and they're not even doing so now before being elected.
I want to bring Ebony into the conversation. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on that as well.
Being an ally is, to me, the biggest way to be a part of the solution, because the trans community is a very, you know, small, it's a microcosm of the society, very even smaller than the LGB community. We're just a very tiny community. So we rely on allyship. Just like Black folks during the Civil Rights Movement relied on allies. There was a lot of Jewish lawyers, people that identified as brown people that were deeply involved in the Civil Rights Movement and fighting for, you know, the liberation of Black people. So we as trans folks, we also need our allies. We also need people to say, stop the hate, stop the bigotry. These are people, and we need to love and accept them just the way they are.
And before I let you go, maybe I know that you're on the clock. Can you give us information about your congressional bid and where people can find out more? A website?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you can find me on social media. You can also find me. Our website is maybeagirlforcongress.org. That's spelled maybeagirlforcongress.org. We are a grassroots campaign. We are completely people powered. I reject all corporate donations. So we really need help, and I need allies to get me into Congress.
Carl, can you give out a website for Lambda Legal and where people can find out more about the work that you do?
Yes, of course. You can find Lambda Legal on the web at www.lambda, L-A-M-B as in boy, D as in dog, A as in apple, legal.org. And this year we are celebrating our 50th anniversary as an organization, and we're the oldest and largest LGBTQ legal advocacy group in the United States. So we'd love to have folks check out our website and learn more about us.
Ebony, can you give us a website for California Transcends where people can find out more about the work that you do?
Yes, www.catranscends, that's with the S, .org. There you can find out information about the work we're doing. We do need to upgrade our website to the work that we're doing this year. It's still illustrating some of last year's work, but that's where we're also on social media. CA Transcends on Instagram, CA Transcends on Twitter, and also California Transcends on Facebook. And you can be updated about the events that we're supporting. We also sponsor events, and you can be updated on that and some of the bills that we will be working on this year.
This has been a special show marking Transgender Day of Visibility for Yes Magazine. I want to thank our roundtable guests, Carl Charles, a senior attorney in the Southern Regional Office of Lambda Legal, located in Atlanta, Georgia; Ebony Harper, founder and executive director of California Transcends, a statewide initiative that is working to promote the health and wellness of transgender people throughout the state of California; and Maybe A Girl, who serves on the Silver Lake Neighborhood Council in Los Angeles, who became the first drag queen elected to public office in the United States. She's also a candidate for California's 30th congressional district. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kolhatkar.
Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band, Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday 2023. On Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute brings together musicians of many genres to pay tribute to influential jazz singer and songwriter Billie Holiday. Performances feature Marsha Hawker, LaRonda Steele, Arietta Ward, and more. Again, that's the 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute Night, Lady Sings the Blues, on Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45.